Good morning. So nice to be here. Looks like people are still wandering in, but it is 10 o'clock, and I think that we'll get started and people can come in as they arrive. I'm so happy to be here again. It's been a while. My name is Heidi Born. I live in Arcata, about 300 miles north of here. And sometimes when Donald and Sylvia are both out of town, I get the honor and pleasure to come teach and be with you. So it's great. I don't think I've been here since June. I was trying to remember when the last time was. So thank you for coming. I appreciate you being here. For those of you whom I haven't met, my background is in both Buddhist practice and in teaching secular mindfulness. I teach both programs that are Buddhist programs, and I bring programs into organizations as a component of staff development. And as of late, this year, I've been doing a fair amount of work with elderly people. And it's amazing. It's just amazing work. It's some of the most difficult work that I've done, and it's really incredibly gratifying to be in a room with people of varying capacities, physical, emotional, like all of us, whether they're some people can see or not, or hear or not, and varying levels of mentation. And it's been a very profound experience of meeting everybody where they are, or trying to do that, and how to be with somebody who has fairly compromised mentation and make a space for them and have every single person feel relevant. I've been really thinking about that a lot. What does it feel like to feel relevant? And how we have, many of us at different times in our lives, can feel irrelevant or marginalized. But working specifically with people who are in the last, years of their lives, or living in ways that they feel isolated or lonely, there's all kinds of research that is showing the direct link between the feeling of loneliness and isolation and illness. Chronic illness and inflammatory disease. And so it's been particularly heartening to be asked to come into organizations that are caring for people at this stage of their lives and teach them to meditate and to talk with them about awareness, whatever they're aware of. I didn't know I was going to tell you about this, but it's okay. A couple of things that people have said to me in these groups. I teach really short meditations to start out. And one day, this was a woman who was recovering from a stroke at a fairly young age, and she definitely had some compromise. And we sat for just 5 minutes, and after that, she said, "Oh my God, that worked! How many of these do we get?" You know, what a thrilling thing to teach somebody just to feel the breath coming and going, or their body sitting right where they are, and they don't have to do anything else except just be right there with themselves. It was really thrilling. Another woman said to me, "Oh, honey, I'm so glad you're here because I always forget to breathe." So, you know, things that we may take for granted that we know or don't know, but to be able to bring that out. The last story I'll tell you from this work that I'm doing, I was at a different facility with a different group, and I would say that most of the people in this group had no exposure to meditation, and the concept of mindfulness and developing awareness and kindness was not necessarily in their language, even though I think that what I'm finding over and over again working with people of older people is that they know this stuff. They know it. We just have a different language for it, and we're just able to bring it out and show them how much they already know. So we were doing a bit of a body awareness. It wasn't so much a body scan, but I was just asking people in the room, so what do you notice in your body right now? And so we were just distilling out, oh, I do feel my back against the chair, or I do feel my bottom in the chair, or my feet are cold, or whatever we notice. And so I asked the question, I said, is anybody noticing any discomfort in the body? And people were quiet and they were thinking about what that was. And one woman said, yeah, I noticed some discomfort over here in my leg. And I said, well, can you describe that? And we know as practitioners that part of our practice is to be able to identify and discern what we're feeling, but it can take time in our lives to put a label to it, that we don't necessarily have the language always to name what we're experiencing, physical, emotional, mental, whatever it is. We don't always have that language. And for somebody who has had a compromising event in their life, it can be even more difficult. So this one person said, yeah, I feel this discomfort in my leg. And I said, can you describe it? And she was quiet for a while, and she said, well, I'm not sure. And so I gave her some language. I said, is it pulsing? No. Is it burning? No. And we went through the different ways to describe sensation. And she finally said, you know, it's stinging. I have a stinging feel. So as many of you may know, or for those who may not know, a very functional practice to do when we are, our attention is drawn into very strong sensation that we're really hooked into, is actually to shift our attention and focus somewhere else in the body that is neutral or maybe extremely comfortable, because it shows us that everything in our experience isn't the discomfort, that we can also experience what is comfortable. So I asked, I said, so is there anywhere in your body that is not stinging? And she was quiet. And this is a person who is in her early 60s in an electrified wheelchair and has significant compromise. She was quiet for a bit and she said, yeah, my mind isn't stinging. And I thought, you just taught the whole class. You just did it. This is exactly what we're talking about here. Is how can we be with whatever our experience is and not have a stinging mind? So it's been thrilling. So that's some of what I've been doing this year. And I wanted to tell you about that because I know when my mind is stinging, I'm caught, and I want to be able to find a place in my body or in my mind or my heart that isn't stinging. So that's part of our practice. Like I said, I didn't plan to tell you that, but I'm happy to have done that. So I love the practice that Sylvia and Donald bring in of welcoming us all here together today, and certainly welcoming anybody who hasn't been to Spirit Rock before. Is there anybody for whom this is your first time? Wow, great. Welcome. Will you tell us your name? Will you introduce yourself?
Jane Gate.
Oh, great. Great. Thank you for coming. My mother lives in Inverness. You probably do. We can talk later. And you, what is your name?
My name's Anthony, and I'm here all the way from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Welcome.
Just got off the airplane yesterday.
Well, welcome. What brings you out?
I have some training next week, down at 1440.
Oh, great.
I have my good friend and dear host that is local. He came out a few days ahead.
Oh, that's great. So what are you doing at 1440? It's brand new. Oh, that's great. Good. I'll enjoy. That sounds wonderful. Good. Thank you. Anthony. So, yes. Great. Welcome.
Julie.
Welcome, Julie.
I live locally, and I also practice Kundalini yoga.
Oh, great. Well, welcome. What inspired you to come here today?
I moved here about 3 years ago. I just keep thinking about it.
Okay. Well, great. Good. Good. I'm glad. Well, welcome. Welcome. And then there's another practice that I know happens in this group every week, which is to pause and just turn to somebody next to you and just say, hello, how are you? So let's do that. I enjoy listening to this class on Dharma Seed every week. And so when I get to that part in the tape in the beginning, I imagine everybody in here saying hello to each other. It's really sweet. What a nice thing to do. So before we sit, I've been thinking about what I wanted to talk with you about today. And last week's class, if you were here, Sylvia was talking about, have you changed your mind about anything? Who was here last week and heard this talk? Okay. And before I heard that talk, one of the things that struck me is that I was going to be here on the one-year anniversary of the election. Yeah, a lot's happened in the last year, hasn't it? So what I really wanted to think about was, well, what have I learned? What have I learned over the last year through all of the twists and turns and dramas that is in our country and in our lives and in our communities at this point? So I would really like to ask you that too, to just reflect for a moment for yourself on what have you learned? And we'll talk about this later, towards the end of our class today. But it's a nice thing just to pause and just feel whatever comes up. What have you learned? And I'll share with you the primary thing that I think that I've learned, and then I'll talk about it after we sit. I love to spend time in the wilderness, and I do regularly. And I realize through all of the changes that are happening in our federal system, that my well-being is really wrapped up into what I've taken for granted of the well-being of our policies that support our earth. So I've been thinking about that a lot, about that intricate connection of what supports me. So I just share that little piece. I am really bound up with the well-being of the earth. It's a really big part of my outlook and how I am. So we'll leave that for now, and we'll sit. But as you sit, you don't need to get caught up in what you've learned and all of the intricacies of that, but there may be something really positive that you've also learned in this last year that you can take heart in, and let that support your contemplative time this morning. You with me on that? It's a very sweet thing to do. It's similar to when Sylvia says, you know, let's think about something, some kindness that you've either done or someone's done for you, to just bring that to mind before you sit. It sets the tone. So what have you learned over the last year that is actually supportive for you? All right, we'll sit for about a half an hour. As you settle into our meditation this morning, getting a sense of the body, sitting just where you are, as you are, feeling how we are supported from the earth below, gravity above and around us, holding us. Feeling the groundedness of the body, letting it be a secure foundation where our practice begins. And in this upright, alert posture, only efforting enough to stay alert. It's not a constricted, tight energy. Allowing the back to be strong. Just strong enough. And allowing the muscles of the chest and the belly to relax. So we can easily breathe. Simply sitting and know you're sitting. Feeling the coming and going of the breath. Just in this moment, breathing with ease. This moment, and the next moment, and then the next one. Simply breathe and know you're breathing. Letting the mind settle down into the breathing and into the body. And we'll sit quietly. poem called Only This Morning from Dan Gerber. In 100 trillion years, an actual number, though we can't begin to grasp it, the last traces of our universe will be not even a memory, with no memory to lament it. The last dust of the last star will not drift in the great nothing out of which everything we love or imagine eventually comes. Yet every day, every 4 hours around the clock, Debbie prepares her goat's milk mix for the orphaned filly who sucks down all 3 liters of it gratefully, it seems, as if it matters more than anything in the universe. And it does, at this moment while the sun is still 4 hours from rising on the only day that matters. Letting yourself come fully into this moment, the only moment that matters, this now. Feeling the breath and the body, noticing the state of heart and mind. Letting yourself be held in this lovely quiet space of mutual practice. I love our Sangha's tradition of mentioning those we're thinking about at the end of our sitting. As I was driving through Santa Rosa yesterday, it was the first time that I drove through since the fires, and I just couldn't believe my eyes, though I'd seen many pictures. And in our practice of wishing well and bringing to mind those who are facing great challenge, I thought, where do we start here? So I'm thinking about all of those who are facing great loss and devastation and sorrow. Who are you thinking about?
Anymore.
Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that we sit for those who can't sit, and we walk for those who can't walk. And we cultivate peace and stillness in our lives for those who have no peace or stillness. And sometimes that includes us. So we hold these sorrows, and we also hold joys. And we know that when we come together and we mention what's on our hearts and on our minds, we feel somewhat soothed. There really isn't much else I'd rather be doing than sitting in a room with people I know and don't know and being in this space. Isn't that just the sweetest thing? Thank you for your practice. Do you want a break? Okay, let's take about five, six minutes. We'll come back at 11. Okay, enjoy. Okay, let's come in, talk with each other. So it seems like sometimes when I listen to Dharma talks that some teachers say, and the title of the talk is, and I've never done that because I don't really know what the title of the talk is until the end of the talk. And then I sort of have to figure it out. But the title of the talk is, one of my favorite teachings from the Buddha is the teaching that says, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. Are you familiar with that? It's really a beautiful teaching. So let me say that again. By protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. I think it's brilliant, and it's a core teaching that I spend a lot of time with. So as a mundane example of that, we have agreed upon guidelines and rules for driving a car. And when we follow the rules, people don't tend to get hurt. But when one person doesn't follow a rule, it may be go through a stop sign or go through a stoplight, we get hurt. So that's just a basic way to think about it, is that when we agree, when I protect myself based on really committing to wanting to live a life that doesn't harm myself or anybody else, I am not only protecting myself, but I am caring for the well-being of everybody around me. And when we have this collective agreement to follow guidelines that have been hopefully developed and set forth by a community for the community's well-being, not only is the community cared for, but each one of us is cared for within that. So I think about a lot about that teaching, and it's a guide, it's a compass teaching for me in many ways. So I said earlier that I have become acutely aware this past year of how intricately connected my sense of well-being is with the well-being of the earth. And as our policymakers have changed at the federal level, it has been completely shocking to me to see the kinds of decisions that are being made that are for the well-being of no one. Really, the well-being of no one. Even the people who are making those decisions are, in my view, besought with greed and ill will and delusion and etc. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about what I've learned and to bring it in to some perspective. I've been reading a book that very slowly that I'm really loving. It's written. It's called The Hour of Land by Terry Tempest Williams. Anybody familiar with her? Isn't she fantastic? She is a really important voice in our culture, not just for the environment, but about what does it mean to be a citizen of this world. So The Hour of Land is an incredible exploration that she's done of 12 national parks in our country, some known well, some not known well. As an example, there's a national park in northeast Iowa called Effigy Mounds National Park. I didn't know anything about it. There's a national park, Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, that is being surrounded by the whole oil and fracking industry, and how is that affecting it? So it's a literary celebration of our national parks, what they mean to us, but more importantly, what we mean to them. And to actually shift not is what is the earth going to do for me, but what am I going to do? How important I am to the well-being of this earth. It's a meditation, and it's a manifesto on why wild lands matter. It's a great book. And here's what, it came out, let me just back up a little bit. It came out last summer on the centennial celebration of the National Park Service. So 2016, in the summer of 2016. Here's what she says. We are slowly returning to the hour of land where our human presence can take a sidestep and respect the integrity of the place itself. Paying attention to its own historical and ecological character beyond our needs and desires. This kind of generosity of spirit requires an uncommon humility to listen to the land first. It's what we need to do to understand why we need the land, what we mean to it. So that was written a little over a year ago when it looked like there were going to be more and more supports put in place for the long-term welfare of our land and our earth. And as things have been being, as things are being dismantled from that perspective, I find it incredibly painful. Incredibly painful. And one of the things that keeps coming up for me that I'm learning about this, aside from how much I love it or how painful it is, but these teachings that we've been given on both the three poisons of greed, ill will, and ignorance, and the three sure things, or the three marks of experience, are suffering, the truth of impermanence, and the truth of our interdependence, interconnection, contingency, because of this, that, how true this all is. So when we study these teachings and we hear over and over again about greed, ill will, delusion, suffering, impermanence, not self, interdependence, we can think of it as a nice idea. And sometimes I think about that. You know, when I'm either teaching or studying, or I hear a talk and I think to myself, well, that sounds right. That sounds like a really good idea. But there's a question in there, which is, how? How does this function in me? So we're not going through our practice as an academic exercise. This is something we actually do, something we actually need to look at. So I've been looking at that. I've been looking at it from the perspective of the pain that I feel around the degradation of the earth in the many ways that we see it. So I'm watching how it works in me. So just looking at intense desire for the earth to be well, for to not see the decline in butterflies, the decline in how many bugs, insects are splatted on the windshield when we drive, that's true too. So many things that we can point to, and that it's a tragedy when a semi-truck in the Central Valley crashes and thousands of bees that are going to the almond trees are dumped and they die because the truck was in an accident. So there are more bees that are now gone. And when we become so intimately aware, excuse me, of what that means and our food supply and all of the interconnection between pollinators and when we actually get food on the table. So I'm noticing my own intense desire for healthy open space that's alive and vibrant. And is there greed in that? What are my own levels of greed? And I like to think it's not greedy at all, but that it's actually just my real deep desire for our earth to be sustainable so we are, so my granddaughter has a healthy environment to grow into. But it's an interesting thing to look at. Where is that line between what we really want and where does it tip over into greed? I want to spend time in the wilderness. I do. I want more of it. I have experienced greed. I'm continually thinking about where's the next place I can go and where are the places I haven't been and where are the places I've been I want to go back to. And it definitely takes me out of my present day moment experience when I'm thinking about where else can I be other than here. And I don't think that I'm unusual in that at all. But just watching that, just see how that works. So again, from The Hour of Land, Terry Tempest Williams says, "The mirage we see dancing on the horizon is more than the tease of water. It is the illusion that what you want, you will have." It's the illusion that what you want, you will have. And we know this firsthand, right, from our practice, that we're always going after what we want. And as soon as we get it, the next desire is right there on its heels. So can we see it as a mirage, as an illusion, as just the next feeling that comes in? So I think for me, that's how a little bit of this intense desire and greed works for me around that. And then the ill will. So then what comes up when I have this experience of seeing policies dismantled or more policies made that are harmful and are blatantly harmful? They're not just subtly harmful. It's blatant. So I have this dismay and sadness. And I have the ignorance also that anybody would do something like that. How could a policy be made that is only good for the greedy welfare of a few at the expense of most of us? And so when I have those moments of outrage, and I can't believe this is happening, that's kind of a delusion, because it is happening. And it's a lot easier for me to be with the difficulty of what is happening when I take that off and say, okay, this, and when I get out of denial and say, this actually is what's going on, how can I respond to this most appropriately? And again, that's our practice, right? We really want to see what is real so we can respond most appropriately. I have a friend who is also a mindfulness teacher. She's up at the University of Idaho. Her name is Jamie Derrick. And we were in a meeting recently in Los Angeles. And we were all checking in about our teaching practices. And one of the things she said was, "I am really trying to hold a space for hate. I'm really trying to hold a space for hate." And I had this very visceral feeling of, I don't know if I can do that. Because I think for as long as I can remember, what I have been informed by and certainly gave the message to my children is that we don't hate. We just don't do that. So what does that mean to actually make space for that? And we see it in our country. Certainly we see levels of hate that haven't been so blatant as they are now in my experience. But what about in ourselves? You know, when we feel that come up, that intense rejection that moves into that place of hate, I think that we can go to a place in our practice that just says, I'm not going to do that. Hatred never ends by hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient law, fundamental teaching from the Buddha and many other wisdom traditions. Certainly Martin Luther King said that. But what happens if we make a space, hold a space for hate? that was really a moment that I thought, this is a really important point, because what we are trying to do is see what's here. We are trying to cut through the delusion of whatever we are feeling and be able to turn towards this difficulty. And yet, notice how hate affects us. Do we act on it or do we not act on it? What we want to do is transform that, but first we have to know what's there. So we see that feeling, and maybe we don't even name it as hate as such, but intense rejection of whatever is happening or what we're witnessing, and what is the action we take in response to that. That's what we want to know. So from the time my children were very little, and they would say, ew, I hate, you know, whatever, fill in the blank, my refrain was always, hate is a very strong word. Can you choose a different word? And I think about that now, and I think, I wish I'd had the courage to say, tell me more about that. What does that really feel like? Instead of saying, no, we don't do that. And that was the message for sure that I was giving, no doubt about it. And I would say to my kids, choose kindness. Just choose kindness. And I do believe that. I think that when we make choices all the time in how we are with whatever's happening in our lives, that when we come from a place of kindness, we often get a better outcome. But we don't do that instead of feeling whatever we feel. So I hate what's happening to the earth. I do. I really do. And so I felt some freedom when my friend Jamie said, you can hold a space for that. You don't have to put it away. We just want to make sure that we act appropriately out of it. We don't want to act in a violent way or in a way that causes harm to ourselves or others. So it was freeing. It was freeing that I could actually acknowledge a very real part of a natural human emotion and then deal with it and then work with it. Here's a poem from Diane Ackerman, School Prayer. In the name of daybreak and the eyelids of morning and the wayfaring moon and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, as a healer of misery, as a messenger of wonder, as an architect of peace. In the name of the sun and its mirrors and the day that embraces it and the cloud veils drawn over it and the uttermost night and the male and the female and the plants bursting with seed and the crowning seasons of the firefly and the apple, I will honor all life, wherever and in whatever form it may dwell, on earth, my home, and in the mansions of the stars. That's beautiful, isn't it? So, this phrase, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred. Okay, let's not dishonor our souls with hatred, but we can acknowledge it when it's there. And so then that brought up for me thinking about the precepts, our five precepts about undertaking the training to not harm living beings and switching that a little bit, or just looking at it from the opposite. Yes, we undertake a training not to harm living beings, but we also undertake a training to support and honor ourselves, to protect life in ways that we can. So looking at it from a different perspective. So it's been a wonderful exploration to look at what have I learned in the last year and to weave in all of these practices and see how they actually are incredibly helpful. They really are profound. And ignorance, you know, as my own delusion around being willing to see, yes, it is exactly like this. There's a lot of freedom in that. A lot of freedom looking at the way all three of these poisons function. Because when we're willing to see how they function, we're less caught in them. The Velcro of the mind loosens up a little bit. And we just say, okay, yeah, this is really what's happening. And so I want to have more clarity about what's actually happening around me and within me. And so we cut through that delusion bit by bit. And we don't have to be hard on ourselves about it either. And then we move into the next three. The three marks of experience. Suffering. There's a lot, right? Challenge, struggle, however we want to talk about suffering. And I know that often when we translate the word dukkha, suffering, from the Pali, there are a lot of different ways that people talk about it. Whether it's struggle, challenge, life is difficult for everybody. But lately I've been really liking the word suffering because it really is what I feel in relation to what's happening in the environment. And not in everything in my life. I have a lot of joy. We all do. You know, we have the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. But the truth of suffering is true. It's real. And then as far as impermanence goes, I think there's a lot of solace that comes from thinking about impermanence. So just in the way I can feel this complete and utter dismay for the policy changes that are happening in our country related to things that I hold most dear, I also really think they can change back. And in that, thank God for impermanence. Seriously, this is so important because we see changes that might be so painful and startling to us, but it's not going to be like this forever. These systems are going to change. Administrations are going to change. This is an important thing to remember, that it's like this right now. I love that teaching, right? It's like this right now. It's not what I wanted. It's what I've got. Okay, it's just like this right now. May I accept things as they are in this moment, so I can respond most skillfully. Last year, I spent a couple of weeks on the Colorado River, going through the Grand Canyon. And that is just an amazing... Anybody been there? Anybody done that? Was it one of the most amazing experiences of your life? Right? Because what goes on there, when you're inside the Grand Canyon, on the river, it is an experience of the deepest time that I think we can experience, because there are places in the Grand Canyon where the walls, the rocks that are exposed, are almost 2 billion years old. That's pretty hard to get your mind around, to be able to touch rock that is nearly 2 billion years old. What's 2 billion? It's a lot of years. And you see what happens as you go on the river. You go, the river goes deeper and deeper into the canyon, and it's a little bit of an illusion, because the river comes in and the walls rise up at the same time, and there are different layers of rock that come from different time periods. So at the deepest point, you're in this rock that is the oldest exposed rock, and you just keep going on the river in these boats, passing by these layers, trying to imagine what was going on in the world, in the people's lives, the different indigenous people that lived in the canyon and farmed in the canyon. Anyway, that's a little bit tangential. But I was in a boat. The boats that we were on are dories. Do you know what a dory is? Most gorgeous 18-foot boat that's wood and fiberglass. It's this elegant boat that's pointed on each side, and there's a central boatman, one pair of oars, and two people can sit in the front and two people can sit in back, and they ride low in the water, and they're elegant and nimble, and it's an extraordinary experience to be in a non-motorized vehicle on the Colorado River. Well, there's a hatch in both the bow and the stern of the boat, and you open the hatch and there's storage in there. And I was sitting in this boat and opened the hatch, and written on the inside of the hatch was, "Thus shall you think of the fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom in a dream." And that's the Buddha from the Diamond Sutra. And it was so sweet to have that inside the hatch of the boat that I was riding in for a couple of weeks, because it was just such a, it's so true. Right now, it is this moment, this flickering light, passing by this wall of astounding rock. And it was just right then. That was what we had in that moment. And so we see that the truth of suffering, the truth of change, and that because of this, that, it's all real. It actually is so, it's very freeing and it's very supportive. And so then when these changes are happening in our world, we don't have to take it personally. And it does feel personal. Sometimes it really does feel personal when some other executive decision is made that we know is going to cause incredible pain and suffering for the people that it's directed towards, or for aspects of our environment. I think that it does feel, sometimes it really does feel personal. And so I've been working on not taking it personally and understanding the causality. It's a practice. It's just a practice. We just have to keep at it. Are you familiar with the photograph Earthrise? Do you know about this photograph? Some of us will know. Let me read this to you and then you'll get it. This is from December 1968, Apollo 8. And Earthrise was the first photo of the Earth that was ever taken from space. So we understood and saw what the Earth actually looked like. So this is the story from the astronauts who took those photos, who were on that spacecraft. It's never easy to identify the moment a hinge turns in history, when it comes to humanity's first true grasp of the beauty, fragility, and loneliness of our world. However, we know the precise instant. It was on December 24th, 1968, exactly 75 hours, 48 minutes, and 41 seconds after the Apollo 8 spacecraft lifted off from Cape Canaveral en route to becoming the first manned mission to the orbit of the moon. Astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders entered lunar orbit on Christmas Eve of what had been a bloody war-torn year for America. At the beginning of the fourth of 10 orbits, their spacecraft was emerging from the far side of the moon when a view of the blue-white planet filled one of the hatch windows. Oh my God, look at that picture over there. Here's the Earth coming up. Wow, is that pretty, Anders exclaimed. He snapped a picture in black and white. Lovell scrambled to find a color canister. Well, I think we missed it, Anders said. Lovell looked through the windows 3 and 4. Hey, I got it right here, he exclaimed. A weightless Anders shot to where Lovell was floating and fired his camera. You got it? Lovell asked. Yep, Anders said. The image, our first color view of our planet from off of it, helped to launch the environmental movement. And just as important, it helped human beings recognize that in a cold and punishing cosmos, we've got it pretty good. Bill Anders said, we came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing is that we discovered the Earth. We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing we discovered was the Earth. And tangentially, I think that when I came to meditation practice, I thought I was just coming to get a little quiet. And the most important thing I started discovering was what it means to be human. I started discovering myself in such a deep way that I never imagined was possible. It's just a little bit of a tangent. But sometimes we come and we think we're going to be discovering one thing and we get a much bigger picture. So back to Earthrise. Just that photo of Earthrise was actually instrumental in the rise of Gaia theory that happened in the 70s from a British physicist. Do you know about Gaia theory? This is really important. It proposes that the Earth functions as a self-regulating living system. And we're messing with that. That the Earth itself and its atmosphere is a self-regulating living system that we are an integral part of. Every living piece of this Earth functions to maintain the homeostasis of the Earth itself. It's important to remember that we're not just living on this earth. We are of this earth. The water in our bodies, wherever we live, wherever our home might be, our bodies are something like 70 or 80% water. So if you're drinking from the water system, wherever you are of that earth. You are that water system, whatever river it might be. That's an amazing thing, you know, when you think about the food that we eat and where it comes from and who grew it and what goes into that food and we put it in our bodies. We are that food. So important to remember this. And not only that, you know, the CO2 and the O2 exchange that is happening all the time, we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide and the trees absorb the carbon dioxide and breathe back out the oxygen. So when we have extensive deforestation, we are choking ourselves. We have to remember this. And I know I'm on a high horse here, but this is so important. This is just so important to our well-being. By protecting ourselves, we protect others. By protecting others, we protect ourselves. And what we do and what we think, how we act, it has consequences. It really matters. So we don't need to then take that and be frightened and be walking on eggshells. We actually can embrace it and say, okay, what I do matters. What do I want to do here? My role that what I offer, what I do in my life matters. So let's let it be wholesome. Let's practice enough so we can be supported in that way. There's another teaching from the Buddha, a question that he poses, which in times of confusion, what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? That's the other compass question from the Buddha that I love very much. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? Now, this is not to say this is all self-centered and self-involved. What, when I do it, is only for myself. We widen that out. But it is also a really wonderful question when we are struggling deeply and personally. So we see the connection between my own actions and how they affect my environment, my family, my community, my work. But when I make really good decisions for myself, they translate outside of myself. So these two practices, these two teachings, by protecting myself, I protect others. By protecting others, I protect myself. And what, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness, or our long-term welfare and happiness. And that helps us take the long view. So when those astronauts saw the Earth from the lunar orbit and they could see the Earth and know it was our collective home, how can we do anything to harm that? You know, we don't squander our homes. We don't intentionally pollute our homes. So for me, spending time in the wilderness reconnects me with my deepest intentions and my best self. And so for all of us, just because that's where I do that, that's just where I do it. But each of us, I believe, has a place, an experience in our lives something that we do, or I hope you do, that connects you to your best self, that place where you feel put together, for lack of a better expression. Where do you feel best? Where do you feel so mostly at home in yourself, so you have the most agency possible to function well in your lives? Part of why I like to, in the last year, I've started offering wilderness meditation retreats, and they are a thrill, just a total thrill to bring people into beautiful places to reconnect with themselves and reconnect with the earth. Because when we do that, we see how much is at stake. And we actually see parts of the earth that we might not even know exist. And so when we find out what is out there and we fall in love and we get inspired, when we get educated, when we get inspired, we tend to protect what we love. So we need to do this. And it might be social justice issues. It might be environmental issues. It can be all these different kinds of issues. But finding the thing that makes your heart sing, that lets you go to work to say, this is what I need to be doing, it's really important. And it's what we need. And we're not all going to have the same draw. We're not. I mean, we can't. We can't. I like to think that if we could take some of our elected officials into some of these pristine places, that they would say, oh my God, okay, I've been misguided. Because people who never see where the water comes from don't know. Or you walk into a high-rise building in a dense urban environment and flip the switch and the electricity comes on. Where does it come from? So, you know, we need to be thinking about that. But I do have a fantasy about, boy, if we could take some of these folks into these amazing places, we could shift their thinking. That's part of my motivation for doing these wilderness meditation retreats. When we get quiet, we all know when we get quiet, we see more clearly, we understand more deeply, our hearts open, and we act more out of love because we protect what we love. And when we connect into experiences of reverence and of awe, it changes us. And I think we need to have experiences of awe, because then we see what's out there, and we see that it is so much bigger than ourselves. Any kind of experience that takes your breath away, that stops you in your tracks, it's a beautiful moment. I think we all know that whether it's reading a book or listening to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or being in the Grand Canyon or being right here in this beauty, when we feel that awe, it ignites reverence. At least I like to think that. That's really how that feels to me. So again, from Terry Tempest Williams, she says, our steps are not measured in miles, but in the amount of time we are pulled forward by awe. Our steps are not measured in miles, but the amount of time we are pulled forward by awe. Awe is the moment when ego surrenders to wonder. And doesn't that feel good when that happens? When our preoccupations with ourselves quiet for a moment, they're just in abeyance, and we can feel that pure awe. Rumi, he says, let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. Let yourself be silently pulled by the strange pull. I got that wrong. Let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. So that wisdom that we have, that thing that pulls us, that says, this is what I love. Listen to that. And just because your best friend is working on something else that's important to your best friend, that's great. We need that to happen too, but listen to what pulls you. Wendell Berry says, the care of our earth is our most ancient and most worthy, and after all, our most pleasing responsibility. To cherish what remains of it and to foster its renewal is our only hope. I love this idea of a most pleasing responsibility. And again, that's different for all of us. Like when we take care of things that are important to us, there's a sense of satisfaction that comes with that. So I want to ask you a couple, I'd like to talk with each other now a little bit. A couple questions, whatever you would like to contribute to a conversation. One question is, what have you learned in the last year that has shifted how you are now? Or when you think of a most pleasing responsibility, what comes to mind? And let's just talk about that. Talk with each other and how that might relate to practice. What have you learned in the last year? Here comes the mic.
Talking to a partner. Well, this is a little embarrassing, but human, I guess. I have changed my mind in the last year, forgive me, everyone, anyone, about Republicans.
Uh-huh.
Because as much as I wouldn't want to cop to being, oh, I can't think of the word I want, but thinking unkindly about a whole group of people, I did. And I probably still do to some respect. But in the last year, I have seen that they weren't a solid one thing, mm-hmm. that they're very different. And many of those people have a deep down kindness and caring about others. And I guess I'm thinking about John McCain, for example, who is sort of a prime example, whom I didn't think I'd ever hear myself saying anything really nice about, but I really appreciate the stands he's taken mm-hmm. that have affected mm-hmm. many people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many others like him.
Yeah.
So I have really softened, I think, in my unilateral disregard for a group, which was as bad as the groups that I was blaming for doing yeah. that. I was doing it too.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting when we see that happening and we start seeing us as fallible human beings? And I think that we have inherent decency. It's important to see that. And thank you for having the courage to say that. Nothing to be embarrassed about.
My learning is as an outsider, because I am not American, obviously, and it's been amazing to me in the last year. I've met so many thoughtful Americans who apologize for their country, and the way they articulate their pain and but so thoughtfully and so. With a deep education and a deep understanding. And I'm just thinking, wow, there's millions of you. And you're so amazing and you love your country so much and you're so thoughtful. And yet there was such fear all the time and such dread. And it just made me feel like, guys, talk to each other. There's so many of you and you're so thoughtful and loving of your land and your country and your people. And rather than spending so much energy in sort of like being dread and fearful and it's all terrible and there's nothing I can do, to really realize, wow, this is a big wake up and there's so many of us and it's fantastic to see it. And in fact, before the election, when there was a fear that that might happen, all these people came out of the woodwork and spoke so articulately, and I just thought, wow, that's a beautiful, beautiful generation of people that just really care. And
so it's
I
really
hope that
hopeful.
They can really connect and become empowered.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. Where's home?
I'm from Australia, but I live in London.
You do. It's nice to have the outsider view that we're a bunch of really good people. Thank you. No, I'm so glad. I mean, who doesn't want to hear that? Right? That sense of that somebody else can give us the view that you're really wonderful despite the difficulty. Yeah, thank you. Who else? Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, Kate.
Hi. I've learned two things in the last year. One is I allow myself to read about our president, our current president, but I don't listen and I don't watch. And that has helped a lot. And I've also learned that the best response for me is to continue to do what I know is my assignment and do it with even more intensity and purpose, and to recognize that each of us has an assignment, and I can't say what your assignment is, nor can you say what mine is, but that each of us needs to pursue our little piece with so much vigor and resourcefulness and intensity.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's so true. Each of our assignments make up the whole. Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry, did we mess up the order?
I think I've learned, I definitely learned a lot, and I'm still learning a lot about my own naivete and my own privilege. It's been really kind of challenging at times, because when Obama was president, I felt, I think, kind of almost soothed and comforted in this way that kind of did put a mirage over my eyes in a certain way. And now I kind of felt like it was like, I felt like the world was arcing in the right direction. And when that was kind of taken from me, and that's how it felt, that it was taken from me personal, like you were talking about, it really opened up that, you know, maybe the world isn't arcing, and can I hold that? Can I hold that maybe the world's not arcing in a better way? And that's more difficult for me to see because it hasn't always been put in my face, as a white person and as a person, you know, with means. So I think I've just had to look at that. And then now I have a son, how am I going to talk to him about privilege, and how am I going to hold a space big enough that, you know, being able to say in some way that the world doesn't always arc for the better. And so that, you know, maybe he's not ripped open in the same way and felt so let down in a certain way.
These are big questions. So even if the world doesn't arc for the better from where we sit, what can we do in our own lives to live from a wholesome place? Because it does matter. It does influence the whole. Yeah, we're learning the painful parts too, not just the wholesome. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, I'm very grateful for this talk, because I just had a visit from my granddaughter, who's 3.5, and we read maybe 47 fairy tales, and they all end with, and they lived happily ever after. And I realized that I myself had grown up on fairy tales, as maybe many others have as well. And they lived happily ever after. So deeply embedded in your orientation toward life and the way things are always going to get better and they're going to work out, And so this past year, certainly we've had this maelstrom of change in the political world that we're all talking about. In addition to that, I've had a loved one fall into mental illness, from which it appears she intends to, rather than emerge, but to dig in, at least that's for the moment. And this is not supposed to happen in a world where things turn out happily ever after. You're not supposed to lose a loved one to mental illness. You're not supposed to lose your democratic institutions. And so what it's brought up for me is similarly to what you mentioned, like this delusion or the ignorance that you referenced earlier in your talk about these unconscious expectations that we hold, and we don't even realize that they're expectations that we're imposing on reality and that keep us from being receptive to reality itself. And it's that, like if I've learned anything in this last year, it's to be more aware of and willing to accept, very hard, reality as opposed to my impositions or my expectations of what it needs to look like.
Thank you. What is your name, please?
Linley.
Linley, thank you. That was beautifully said. We don't live happily ever after, right? It's not a fairy tale. One more, Chris. Thank you. And I'm sorry for your loved one and the mental illness. It's a big deal.
I just wanted to mention that yesterday was a good day. Today was a good day in terms of the political realm. And that all is not lost on one day alone. And that I really liked your theme, keeping yourself, holding yourself open to different experiences, even hate. Mm-hmm. And I'm not one, I don't march for an emotion. I don't, you know, I don't march against hate or love, if, or for love, although I'm for those, for love and against hate. It's, but yesterday was a real good day, and things get better. Locally, at Fairfax, we had a terrific turnout and a fantastic outcome. So I just want to say all is not lost.
That's right. Thank God for impermanence. Yes. Yes.
The nice part about impermanence is it applies to both the positive and the negative.
That's right. That's right.
I'm reading Jack Kornfield's book, and he's talking about vastness. He's talking about, the bad, it'll go away too.
Yeah.
The good, it's not going to stay here forever.
Right.
And, you know, going back a number of years, it took 37 months from the time the Watergate burglary took place, 37 months before Nixon resigned. We're just at the beginning of this.
Yeah.
So add some historical perspective to it. Mm-hmm. This too shall pass.
Yeah, we need to take the long view. It's very, very true. Okay, yes, one more. Yes. That's right. That's right. Thank you, Tara Brock. Radical acceptance. So let's just talk about that for a moment. Radical meaning from the root, not meaning extremist, meaning complete. Complete acceptance. It doesn't mean we like it. It means we acknowledge it. This is what's going on. We can go back to a fundamental definition of mindfulness, the kind, intentional awareness of whatever is happening right now, whether we like it or not, isn't the issue. But it'll change, knowing it'll change. So we can respond with the most appropriate response possible. I'm going to sit for a couple minutes. We'll end, and then I'll tell you about a couple things. So let's just return to quiet, please. Letting all the conversation go. Just feel yourself right here as you are. This is Jack's autumn blessing for us all. You have been given the energy of the stars, this life force, and you have the capacity to do all kinds of things with it. May you use this energy to plant beautiful seeds, to work for justice, to care for others and this earth, and to do it in your own special way. May you use your meditation and your spiritual practices as a way to cultivate and open your heart in your being to this possibility. Thank you, Jack. May everyone everywhere be safe, have shelter, enough to eat, health care, peace of mind. Thank you so much for your practice, your kind attention, coming out this morning, hanging out with me, practicing together. Thank you for being here. It's really sweet. So, just a little plug. On the back table, if you would like to be on my mailing list, you can leave me your name and your email address. And I don't send out too many emails. I just send out notifications on courses that I offer, or wilderness retreats more specifically, which are open to anybody who is interested in that kind of thing. I am doing a trip on the Yampa River in Utah in May. It's going to be incredible. And there's a flyer in the back. And what it is that I partner with an outfitter called Oars, which is a fantastic wilderness outdoor adventure company. And they do all the work. And I overlay a meditation retreat into the wilderness retreat itself, which is really very sweet. We have silent mornings, and then we get on the river, we do our wild river stuff, and we have silent hikes, come into camp after being on the river, and after dinner have a talk and go back into silence. So we get to be silent in the wilderness from after dinner till after breakfast, get to be active during the day, and it's a very special experience. So, flyers in the back if that is something you're interested in. And that's about it. Thank you so much. You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.